I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are doing a special live stream in honor of Jonathan Bowden. Jonathan Bowden died 10 years ago today, less than 2 weeks before his 60th birthday. And we are going to have a season of celebration of Jonathan, basically. We are beginning with a live stream honoring his death. And on the 12th, which is his birthday, his 60th birthday, Countercurrents is going to be launching a new website called Jonathan Bowden Archive, which will be a place that we hope will draw like a magnet to it information about his life and work. We're trying to assemble all the surviving copies of his audio and video recordings, articles that he wrote over the years. We're hoping to collect correspondence, photos, basically everything that somebody would need to write a definitive biography of Jonathan someday. We want to make all of that material available to the public and honor him. His life and his work are in our hands now, and we want to carry it forward, and we want to prevent his life from being devoured by basically time and indifference and hostility by providing a place to preserve anything connected with his memory. Today, I want to talk to several of Jonathan's friends, people who knew him for years. And the first person I want to bring on is Adrian Davis. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg.
Adrian is a barrister in the UK. He's somebody I've known since 2001. I met you more than 20 years ago for the first time.
That's a frightening thought. That really is.
Yeah. Well, Adrian is consistently one of the most interesting and entertaining and well-informed people in this movement that I've ever met. And I always enjoy conversations with him. And it's about time. And I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk because Adrian knew Jonathan for quite some time. When did you first meet him?
That's actually a very interesting question, Greg, which I've been pondering. I can tell you that I had certainly met Jonathan in the 1990s, in the early 1990s. I'm trying to pin down precisely when, and it's actually not easy. I can think of a couple of friends and acquaintances of mine, two in particular, of both whom you will most certainly have heard, as it happens, who are obsessive diarists. They're men who at the end of every day, however long, however hard, will sit down and spend 30 minutes with pen and ink writing out the most important events of their day in their diaries. Well, I can tell you that I've tried that once in my life when I was on holiday and kept it up for a fortnight, and I have never ever been able to do it any other time, which I'm going to regret one day. If anybody ever goes through my diaries, they will find the jottings of telephone numbers and social and business appointments, which means that if we're going back to the time before I started using a computer, before effectively I have every letter I ever wrote, though not, of course, every letter I've ever received since 1998, because they're all backed up on old hard disks and I can access stuff from 25 years ago now. But Jonathan I met before that time, I'm reckoning it could have been so long ago as 1990, but certainly I'd met him 30 years ago by 1992. I remember the day actually extremely well. It was a warm, not to say hot, summer's evening in the East End of London. And Jonathan, I'd never met Jonathan before, a friend of mine, then friend of his, with whom he had something of a falling out in circumstances that I don't fully know, Stuart Milson, who was a very well-known figure himself in right-wing conservative and even more radical circles in the late 80s and early 90s. Stuart had met Jonathan and told me about this really interesting person he'd just met who ought to be introduced to me. And he brought him to meet me and a friend of mine called Ralph Harrison. who was also quite well known in right-wing conservative and also in Odinist circles in those days, in the East End of London. And we met up in the very enriched area of Shoreditch near Liverpool Street railway station in London, which your English observers, your English listeners may know, at least those of them who are from London, south of England. It was quite an extraordinary event because I remember seeing Stuart and Jonathan walking down the road to meet me. And Jonathan reminded me of, dare I say, rather stouter version of the poet Algernon Charles Swinburne, who I actually rather like as a poet. He had the same very, very bright red hair. I think it darkened with time, but in those days when he was more than 30 years younger than he would be now, it was absolutely flame red. And with the sun shining on it in the evening, it looked quite otherworldly, actually, or out of worldly. I'm sure Jonathan would have liked to create that impression. He looked really like some sort of avatar that had stepped out of a film about the ancient Celtic world rather than a real human being.
That's very, very interesting. So do you know something about his time with the Monday Club and the Revolutionary Conservative Caucus and things that happened before he got involved with the BNP?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. I counseled him against joining the BNP, I have to say. I think Eddie, who you'll have on later on, gave him the opposite counsel. And I think Jonathan had ample opportunity to make up his mind which of us was actually right over the longer term. But no, I knew him in conservative circles in which I was in those days. And they were, in my view, a very, very interesting period of Jonathan's life. I should say that if you are preparing a Bowden archive, something that you really need to have for it are the issues of his Revolutionary Conservative magazine. I think I have the complete set. It contains some very, very interesting writing. And is obviously enormously rare and difficult to get, but I'm glad to say I've preserved my copies, and I have a complete collection. At some point, I'll get them scanned in and sent to you.
That's wonderful.
They are invaluable.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I saw a live stream that Eddie Butler did not too long ago about Jonathan, and I saw him hold up a copy of that, and I was thinking, I covet that. I want to get copies of that magazine for the website. So I'm glad to know that you kept yours, and we can get them scanned someday. That's great news.
Yes, they're only a few feet from where I'm sitting at this moment, although they're not quite so accessible as that makes it sound, because they are in boxes full of literature in my office, and I would have to do some seriously heavy lifting. As you know, anything made of paper weighs an absolute ton, and the younger generation, who are used to having everything on PDFs and online, keeping physical archives is bulky and they weigh whatever. But yes, I know exactly where they are, and I'll get those scanned in for you. I haven't read them for 30 years, so I should be very, very interested to reread them and see what I make of them now.
So are you in touch with any of the people who associated with Jonathan at that time? I'd be very, very curious to get impressions of Jonathan PBNP, pre-BNP, and also people who actually contributed to that magazine. I'd love to be able to speak to them.
Well, I'll see what I can do for you in that respect. I know that Alex Kurtagic was working on a biography of Jonathan, and he had done an enormous amount of work towards that end, and indeed I supplied quite a bit of archival material to him, which I shall also happily supply to you. I don't know where that's going at the moment. I'm not in regular contact with Alex, and I don't know whether you are, but he did. I know he has an awful lot of work in meeting people from that period. I know some of them myself anyway. Stuart Milson is a good friend of mine with whom I'm in touch. He's not very involved in politics these days and hasn't been for a long time, but he and I are still in touch. As for other people from the Monday Club in that period, I'm very friendly with Gregory Lord of Frost, who organized the traditional Britain group. It would be fair to say that Gregory and Jonathan did not get on like a house on fire. That would be putting it mildly. They were not a mutual admiration society, if I can put it that way. But Gregory will certainly remember him from that period, as I do. As I say, I knew him well in those days. I was very disappointed when, much against my advice, he decided to go down the path that he did. And actually, I then very much sort of made up with him years later. Jonathan was an interesting person in that respect. On one level, I could say that I knew him from around, I think, very early 1990s, literally up to his death. And I think I last saw him a few days before his death. On the other hand, that would not be, in every respect, completely accurate summary, because there were long periods in that time, periods of years and years of time, when I didn't see him or hear from him. He would vanish and do other things and pursue other interests and then pop up again. So there were periods of time when I didn't see him for years. As I say, I can have some idea of that in the relatively more recent period by just looking at my correspondence with him, where I have at least the letters and emails that I sent him, not necessarily the ones that he sent me, because he tended to use hard copy all the time. But there were periods of years and years at the time, I mean several years at the time, and I literally didn't hear from him. He'd gone off and was doing other things, and then all of a sudden he'd reappear.
That's interesting. What was, tell us your first impressions of him, aside from his appearance, his personality.
I'll tell you exactly what I said to Alex Kurtagish, because Alex asked me about this many, many years ago. I said the same thing to you. I said to him, the moment I saw Jonathan, it struck me that this was someone who was either going to like very much or dislike very much. And I wasn't quite sure which at the time. Best qualities with Jonathan, those are very easy. He had an exceptional mind and was very, very widely read indeed. And furthermore, never a dull moment with him, I think you could say this. He was someone with whom you could speak for hours, and there were still endless more topics of conversation at the end of the evening. But I say I'd meet him in the 1990s. Often we'd meet near Paddington Station, which, again, for those who don't know London, Jonathan lived in Reading, which is a large town, I would say about 30 miles to the west of London. And the trains from Reading all come into Paddington, which is one of the big stations in London. So we'd meet near Paddington Station so he could easily get his train back. And we'd meet in a pub or a cafe or whatever. And sometimes conversation would go on till about 11:30 at night, at which point I had to remind him that if he didn't toodle off back to Paddington in fairly short order, he'd be sleepy on the platform at Paddington, which would not be a completely pleasant experience. But yeah, you could meet Jonathan at 6 o'clock in the evening, and at 11:30, you'd hardly have got into the various topics of conversation. There was so much to discuss.
That was very much the impression I had of him when I first met him. The first time I met him was in October of 2009, when he came to Atlanta to give a speech that one of my greatest regrets is that I did not record the speech. It wasn't the policy of the organization.
I was present at that speech, as you may recall. Yeah. And I know the organization that you mean. And as they always say, it's not a secret society, but by any means, but some of the people who attend would rather their names weren't mentioned, so I'm not bothered about mine being mentioned, but I know exactly what you mean. It was quite a remarkable speech. That was an extraordinary performance. I think that's perhaps the best of Jonathan's speeches, and that's high praise, as he made very many fine speeches. That was a remarkable event.
Yeah, and I remember he arrived from the UK, and I think you were one of the people who was picking him up. Is that correct? And his phone didn't work in the United States, and he called me in a panic from a payphone. I guess there still were things like that 10 years ago, 11 or more.
I regret to tell you it's 13 years ago, not 10.
13, yeah. Good Lord, yeah. So 13 years ago, he found a payphone at the Atlanta airport, and I said, well, just get in a cab and come to this address. And so half an hour later, he showed up. I paid the cabbie $50 or something. And he showed up at my apartment, and he was carrying a long box, a cardboard box labeled Samurai Sword, made in Taiwan. And I was wondering how he got this through customs, through the security apparatus, I guess, of the airport. But it had a rolled up painting of his in there that he brought me. And that was my first of three Jonathan paintings. And I was going to get a bunch more, but he died, unfortunately, before we could see one another again. But yeah, I found him just immediately engaging, has this very sort of bright face, just sat down and just started talking and held his own. It was very, very entertaining to meet him. And yeah, he did a remarkable performance at that event. And then he went off to Florida, I think with you and Sam Dixon. Is that correct?
Yes, that was an absolutely hilarious and quite bizarre couple of days. I had tried to explain to Jonathan that the climate of southern Florida is quite unlike anything that he would ever have experienced in England. And I think he was really disbelieving about this. He couldn't accept that there are such things as heat and humidity. And he had clothes that were really suitable, not even for an English summer, more for an English spring or English autumn, in a sweltering Key West. I think Sam got so afraid that Jonathan would get heat stroke wandering around in wool suits or whatever, he had to kit him out in lighter tropical wear for fear of seeing his guest come to a literally sticky end. It's very, very funny, but I don't think Jonathan had ever had the experience of traveling outside Europe at that stage, and he had certainly never encountered anywhere such as the Florida Keys in warm weather. That was beyond his range of experiences.
Yeah, I saw him for the second time after that trip. He came back to Atlanta before he flew back to the UK, and a friend and I met with him. We picked him up at the airport, and he had this enormous layover, like 8 hours or something like that. And so we picked him up at the airport, and we took him to a restaurant, and it was an all-you-can-eat Argentinian steakhouse type thing. And he was so amused. He had a small plate of food, and he was so amused at how much food Americans would eat. And he said, it was very interesting in Florida. We spent most of our time sitting around dining.
Yes. Well, that does actually astonish me. It's not surprising that the United States has one of the world's worst epidemics of obesity. Just astonished at how much people eat and how unhealthy some of it is. But there you are.
Yes, well, I was going back for seconds and thirds of some things, but anyway, he was very amused by that. He said he had a wonderful time in Florida, and he could just talk forever. He seemed to be energized by the company, by the audience. I take he was sort of an extrovert by constitution. He seemed to like an audience. He seemed to be energized by people. But then sometimes he would just sort of go blank and non-communicative, and it was like he needed to go inward for a while and recharge. I I found that a little disconcerting sometimes. I didn't quite know what was going on. Was he bored? Has he been offended or whatever? But he did sort of have an on-off switch for social interactions. Did you ever notice that?
Well, I said to you, I think that was attenuated by the time that you met him. When I knew him in the 1990s, he was either a fizzing live wire full of ideas and energy and couldn't wait to do this or meet that person or discuss whatever, or he just went off radar, as we say, for protracted periods of time, mm-hmm. sometimes for years. I don't mean weeks and months, I mean years.
Yeah, that is interesting. I wonder what was going on during the lost years. We're going to have to assemble a complete chronology of his life, I think.
Again, you should speak to Alex about that. He has done a lot of work on it. There are certainly mysteries there. Mysteries. There is a great deal about Jonathan that many people who thought they knew him didn't know. And I'm sure there's yet more to be unraveled.
Well, what are some of those mysteries? I know that he had constructed the story of having a family that he didn't actually have. I thought that was kind of fascinating.
That was quite disturbing. Jonathan was, if you want a literary trope, he was the ultimate unreliable narrator. And one of the difficulties with writing Jonathan's life story is that if he is your source, you need to be a little careful in deciding whether what you have been told is the plain unvarnished truth, an embroidered version of the truth, or something that or no relationship whatsoever to the truth. The family story was an example of the latter, and was worrying, frankly. It's worrying.
Yeah, that is very strange. I've looked at all of Jonathan's art, including things that were never published. I went to see Michael Woodbridge in Wales. I think it was in 2014. I was in 2014, and I looked at hundreds of paintings and drawings, and there's no question in my mind, just given his subject matter, that he was heterosexual, but he seemed to be somewhat secretive about his personal relationships, and then he had constructed this whole story of a family that didn't exist. Did you know any women that he was involved with at all?
No, I always respected Jonathan's privacy in that respect. There's a saying that we all have a public life, a private life, and a secret life, and there is some truth in that. But I took Jonathan's stories at more or less face value till fairly late in the day. And not being the kind of person who would make up stories of that kind myself, it didn't occur to me that he might be doing so to me. It was so strange that I can't understand what leads someone to do that, frankly. It's just so far beyond my experience, beyond my own way of living my life, that I cannot comprehend it.
Mm-hmm. Who were figures that he modeled himself after? Did he have heroes that he imitated or followed?
I wouldn't say that he modeled himself upon anyone in particular. He was a one-off and really an English eccentric and almost a caricature of the English eccentric in many respects. He was someone more from the world of books and literature and philosophy than from the world of politics in many ways. Yet he became very involved in politics in a way, I suppose, that French intellectuals often do, but English intellectuals rarely do. So he was an unusual figure. I can't think that there was anyone upon whom he consciously modeled himself, because he was the unreliable narrator, I now treat with care things that he told me that at the time I assumed were true, because that's my general working assumption with people. For example, he told me that Bill Hopkins, one of the original Angry Young Men, author of The Leap, also known as The Divine and Decay, had been a major influence upon him. Yet a mutual friend of yours and mine, and frequent contributor to your website, who did know Bill very well, our friend Margot, tells me that she never heard Bill mention Jonathan's name to her in all the years she knew Bill. Now, that's a very odd circumstance.
Yeah, that is very odd. I know that Bill Hopkins's widow sort of bristled at any mention of Jonathan, but I don't really know why, and I don't even know if she's still alive. I think her name is Carla. She was very opposed to any thought of Countercurrents reprinting The Divine and the Decay, even though it had been out of print for some time, because I was friends with Jonathan. I could never get to the bottom of that. I guess she had no objection if a Trotskyite publisher would republish a book or something, but not a friend of Jonathan. So that was a peculiar thing. I wonder what was going on there.
I don't know what was going on there. Clearly, he did have some kind of involvement or dealings with Bill Hopkins, and evidently he created the poor impression upon Mrs. Hopkins, from what you tell me.
Yeah. So, can you share some of your more amusing Jonathan anecdotes?
Goodness. It's casting my mind back a long time. I have to say, I can think of one in particular as one of his platform speeches, which is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Jonathan was speaking at a meeting in little town called Wombourne in Staffordshire about allegations that had been made of, shall we say, financial chicanery of various kinds against a very well-known movement personality, which movement personality had decided to expel his own treasurer from his party for accusing him of financial irregularities. And here's Jonathan on a stage in front of 200 or so rather excitable people listening to all these revelations. Unbeknownst to him, the villain of the piece is hiding behind a large curtain at the back of it, listening to Jonathan's denunciation of himself while pretending not to be there. And Jonathan produces from his pocket a pound coin. Now, by that stage, we didn't have pound notes anymore. We had pound coins because inflation had eroded the value of our currency. And he holds up this coin and he says to the audience, "You can't expel the treasurer for saying, 'Where's that quid?'" Quid being the slang English term for a pound, as a buck is for a dollar in the US. Mm-hmm. "You can't expel your treasurer for saying, 'Where's that quid?' Especially where you can't say where the quid is," which was one of the little difficulties. The whole audience just convulsed in laughter. It was a very, very funny line. Mm-hmm. Another classic, going back way before that time, going back to the 1990s, Gregory Lord of Frost, who I mentioned before, and who's still very much active and with the Traditional Britain Group, organising one of the more interesting and successful non-party political organisations that exist on this side of the Atlantic, had organised a meeting for no less a personage than Jean-Marie Le Pen, which took place in a big hotel in London, the Charing Cross Hotel. All my anecdotes of London seem to take place in or around railway stations as part of examined enthusiasts. So the Charing Cross Hotel is a big hotel on Charing Cross Railway Station, which has been used for meetings on a number of occasions. And Le Pen came over. Of course, there was a mob of various antisocial elements, what you'd call Antifa in America these days, though they weren't called that then, kicking off outside. There was a very large police presence, and the whole event was, shall we say, distinctly lively. Well, I think I was at that dinner. The next morning, I switched on my television before going to work. These were the days when breakfast television was very popular, before we had the internet and all that sort of thing. The BBC London News, a very important daily broadcast. And who do I see on television but Jonathan Bowden giving an account of the night before's events, the BBC reporter. And he did it very, very well indeed. It was most impressive, most impressive.
I wonder if there's a tape of that out there somewhere. I would love to see.
Oh, there will be in the BBC archives.
Okay. Well, that is
actually definitely... that's one which you could probably localize more easily than some other things, mm-hmm. simply because the date of Le Pen's meeting at the Charing Cross Hotel, you'll be able to look up easily in archives, and then yeah. the BBC news will be the next morning. And I can tell you more or less exactly what the time was. It was about 20 past eight. I know that because in those days I used to catch the 8:47 train from Clockhouse London Bridge every morning to turn in at work at 25 past nine with a 9:30 start time. And so it would have been about 20 to 25 past eight on the morning of the next day. And it was a very, very, yeah, so it's actually easy to locate in terms of working out what the day was. And there were so few television channels in those days. It was BBC One. Mm-hmm. So this is all the great advantage of things from 30 years ago, that we didn't have 437 different channels on the internet the way that you do now. You know exactly what it was. It was BBC Radio. It was BBC London News. Mm-hmm. But he was very, very good.
Well, that's interesting. That's something definitely to look up and try and track down. I want to bring on Eddie Butler and keep you on, of course. I'd like to add another voice to the conversation. You introduced me to Eddie, and I'm very, very grateful to that, because he's another person who's known Jonathan since the 90s. So, Eddie, let's see if we can bring him on. Eddie, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound great. I'm glad to make your acquaintance. I watched a podcast, a live stream you did not too long ago about Jonathan. I found it very, very interesting. And I'm glad to have you on. And I figure the three of us would just have a conversation about Jonathan for a while. And in the next hour, I hope one or two other people can join us. It might just be the three of us, though. Eddie, can you tell me a bit about yourself? I understand that you are an activist in the UK nationalist scene, and that you were involved for a while in the BNP. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, I got involved first. I feel like I'm embarrassed to say this, but I joined in 1980. In the National Front, as it was, mm-hmm. and left that to join the BNP in 86, and left for a while. I met Adrian around that time. Well, I don't know when I met Adrian first, actually, probably in the early 80s, I'm going to suspect. Didn't know him terribly well, but I used to see him at things occasionally, at fringe type crossover Tory things, maybe. Mm-hmm. And which there were in those days, and I left the BNP in 96, and I knew Jonathan by then and Adrian rather better. We collaborated, me, Jonathan, Adrian, and some other people in a thing called the Bloomsbury Forum, which I don't think Adrian mentioned. Did you? I don't think you mentioned it during your talk, Adrian, and Ralph Harrison, who he also mentioned, and various other people, which was a conscious attempt to bridge the gap between the right wing of the Tory party, which did exist at that time, sort of semi-Monday Clubbish type groups. Mm-hmm. I think the Monday Club was sort of in its disintegration phase then, but and the overt right of things like the BNP, and we then got back in. I did anyway, got back involved. And Adrian sort of did it. He's probably not going to admit this too much, but he did a bit actually, sort of get involved a bit with the BNP about 1999. And when John Tyndall, who you may have heard of, was replaced by Nick Griffin, and with Johnson as well. And we sort of flitted about on the fringes as the Bloomsbury Forum. And then there was a bit of a squabble developed within the BNP, and we formed the Freedom Party, again, me, Johnson, and Adrian, and a few others, which was, I would describe it as a conscious, it was sort of aping the Austrian Freedom Party in a way, which was quite prominent at that time. I'd say that was probably why we called it the Freedom Party. That was sort of the, and that sort of Euro populist type wave that was starting off in that period. And I then rejoined the BNP in 2003, and Johnson joined shortly after. And you know, we deserted Adrian, unfortunately, in the Freedom Party. And then we stayed in the BNP, well, I did, until 2010 or 11 or something, 11 probably, 10. And it was a bit of a, and I mean, I'm a thing called the For Britain movement now, which is a group allied with the Marine Le Pen's party across Europe, and Salvini's party, and the Austrian Freedom Party, and various other parties, Alternative for Deutschland and so forth. We're part of a European group with them.
Okay. So when did you first meet Johnathan? About what year? And can you tell us your first impression of him? Did you take a liking to him at first?
Yes. Well, I met him first in, I think it was the back end of 93. In 93, the BNP first gained worldwide attention. I think it's fair to say it did gain worldwide attention because it won a by-election in a place in London, a council by-election, which is only for a rather small area, but it was very much magnified in publicity terms as a sort of big world-shattering event, because it was rather unusual for a overtly far-right sort of party to win anything. And we won in a first-past-the-post battle in the East End of London. We won this seat. I was the sort of organizer of it, and but I had always been in favor of building bridges with the right wing of the Tory party, because the nationalist movement in Britain was always rather split between the overt nationalist parties like the National Front or the British National Party, and those other people in the right wing of the Tory party. There was nothing like the UKIP or anything like that. Nothing like that was around in those days, and so there was the right wing of the Tory party, things like the Monday Club, for example, and there's a thing called Western Goals and various other sort of ginger groups on the fringes of the Tory party. And you had the sort of more middle class people with better jobs and so forth were in that sort of group, and the more working class people, you might say people with nothing to lose in life or society, were in things like the BNP. But the movement couldn't really move on while they were separate. So I'd always been very much in favour of bringing these things together, or trying to. And so someone, a mutual friend who Adrian knows, by called Mike Newlands, he used to go to Eurosceptic type meetings, which was on these bridge areas, and met Johnathan at one of them. And he said to me, "Oh, there's this guy I know. You'd be interested in meeting him." And so he arranged. We met in this place called De Keys, which is a Polish restaurant in South Kensington in the West End of London. It had a bit of a raffish air to it, De Keys, and had associations with various spy scandals in Britain in the 1950s and 60s, because it was Polish, I guess, you sort of had Eastern Bloc Iron Curtain type people going there and passing secrets under the table. So it had that sort of atmosphere to it, which I guess appealed to Johnathan. And we met there, and we had sort of borscht and red wine and stuff, and quite a lot of red wine, actually. And we got on instantly, actually, very and became firm friends almost instantaneously, actually. and I was friends with him until he died. Adrian, I was listening. Adrian said that there were vast periods when he disappeared. I didn't really experience him disappearing, to be honest with you. I was in contact with him constantly from then until his death, pretty much.
Well, that's interesting. Can you tell me the things that impressed you most favorably about him, and maybe some of the things that were less pleasant about him? And I just sort of want to get a full picture of how you got on.
Lots of people knew him rather he could lord it over people, and he liked to hold court. And some of the descriptions, I think I heard you were saying, like when he was sitting there and he'd almost hold court with a group of people who were like supplicants, wasn't he? He liked that. But I didn't have that sort of relationship with him. Mm-hmm. And he was, I'll tell you one thing, he was actually slightly in private scornful of people who regarded him in that way. He had a bit of a harsh sense of humour, but actually I have as well. So we we had a bit of a common ground in having a, Adrian has as well. Adrian's got a bit of a harsh sense of humour, whether he'll admit to that or not, he has. But me and Jonathan had a very similar sense of humour in that respect. And we just got on. And so I didn't know all about his foibles. Adrian was saying about lots. He had a slightly Walter Mitty character to him, Jonathan, where he constructed a bit of a fake, you know, fake backstory basically about himself, and which Adrian was sort of touching upon there. That didn't really bother me, to be honest. I sort of understood that he had it, and there are areas I wouldn't touch on because of it in conversation with him. But he, so I didn't judge him harshly for that. I just liked him as a person, and I wasn't that much of a fan of his speeches, to be quite honest with you.
That's interesting, because I would say 90% of the people who are listening to this and who will listen to this first heard about Jonathan as an orator. That's how I was introduced to him.
That's because it's like knowing someone who's an actor from his stage performances and not knowing them as a person, isn't it? It's a bit like that. I liked him as a person. And we did have very, very lengthy. We used to drive around. I used to go to meetings with him. We'd drive around the car, spend hours and hours with him talking about politics primarily, current affairs, what we should do, what's the right approach we do, what is theoretically the best way to promote things and get things moving, or to appeal to the British people. What are the things which will get them going or take their interest? These sorts of things. We talked at inordinate lengths. But that wasn't that wasn't him performing. Right. Most people know him as a performer, don't they? Virtually everyone only knows him as a performer, actually, which in a way wasn't really him.
The first two times I met him, it was very much in the context of him being on stage. And then the third time that I met him was in 2012, not long before his death. I had him fly out to California for a weekend retreat that Countercurrents was putting on. Mm-hmm. By this time, he had written dozens of articles for Countercurrents and was dropping the name in his speeches at the London Forum and the New Bright, and he was a supporter. And so I appreciated his mind and I appreciated his talent, and I wanted him to come and give another speech like the one that I so foolishly did not record that he did in 2009. So he agreed to come out. We flew out to San Francisco, brought me another one of his paintings, which I still have. I have three of his paintings now. And he was, he was tired from the trip, but very, very gracious and easy to get along with. We took him to my apartment. I put him in the guest room and he freshened up. And then we went out to dinner in San Francisco. And in February in San Francisco, it's not terribly cold. It's foggy. It's atmospheric. We went to a restaurant down near Washington Square. in sort of the edge of the edge of the Italian neighborhood, basically. Then we went to a very famous bookstore called City Lights, which he knew about because it was associated with the Beat Movement. And it was so entertaining watching him in a bookstore. He was just, I just wondered if we were going to have to physically, drag him out of there, if not, he'd be there till closing time. Suddenly he drew this magnifying glass out of his pocket and was reading things through the magnifying glass and looking at various books. And he could easily get lost in that kind of stuff. He was interested in graphic novels. He was interested in deep literature. It was just quite interesting spending time in a bookstore with him.
He had a very eclectic interest. I'd forgotten, actually, you just mentioned the magnifying glass. I'd forgotten that because his eyesight had strangely deteriorated over the last few years of his life. When you just said that, I just remembered he did used to suddenly drag this magnifying glass out, which was always a bit odd. But he, in that podcast which you said you referred to, I mentioned there that we used to go on these trips to Hay on Wye, and again, Adrian was one of the main people who used to go on these trips to Hay on Wye, which Hay on Wye is a small town on the English Welsh border where that's devoted to secondhand bookshops, and Jonathan used to acquire hundreds of these books. And you're quite right, it'd almost be like an animal consuming the book, reading them, and almost like some sort of animal eating the book almost. That's how he'd look.
And very true, yes.
It was slightly disturbing, in fact. And he would buy a huge... Jonathan was rather poor. I'm interested you say that you go, like, he came around my house, you turn around, he'd be in the bath. He'd be having a bath without asking or anything. You'd say, well, where's it gone? And then you'd find he's locked in the bath and there's a sloshing sound where he's having a bloody bath. And it's a bit, it doesn't normally happen, going, popping into someone's house, saying he's having a bath, but he would because he didn't have proper facilities. He was in, and he'd say things like, it's no more than the price. One of his sayings was, it's no more than a price for a tray of drinks. But he could never afford to buy a tray of drinks. He was incredibly poor. If you were giving food away in America, I can imagine he probably eagerly devoured it, I'd imagine. But
I bought him a bunch of books and I bought him a laptop too and a microphone and sent him back. And of course he died. This was in February and he died not a little more than a month later.
At least 6 months of his life, he'd had something of a breakdown. So you saw him post that second visit, you saw him there. He went through a bit of a personality change, actually, in post-breakdown. Mm-hmm. And he was under sort of medication. And he was less animated than when you first saw him, because I only saw him a couple of times after his breakdown. And he was like a shadow of his former self, basically. But the talks that he gave, and there's quite a few, he became quite busy. He went into some sort of he was in Britain they say sectioned, which means you're forcibly detained under some sort of mental health act, or I don't know exactly the legal ramifications of it, but he was forcibly legally detained under in some sort of facility, and I had a few phone call conversations with him, and he was hearing voices and all sorts of strange things. And I met him on day release. The last time I met him, he was on day release from it. And he was totally normal. He was quite subdued, but he was relatively normal. Took him out for a meal with someone else. We had a meal in a nice little village near Reading. But when the recordings that you see of his speeches after that compared to ones before, they're more thoughtful speeches, they're more coherent and structured, but less animated.
Yeah, when I saw him just before he died, he gave a very good speech, Western Civilization Bites Back in Santa Cruz, California. He gave a wonderful interview, a couple hours interview that I recorded. They're both up at Countercurrents. I also have video of the Santa Cruz speech that I should release someday, because the location that it's in, you know, it doesn't matter if the location is doxed at this point. It doesn't even exist anymore. So I'd like to put that up. But he was quite entertaining. He didn't seem all that subdued, but he get this kind of distant quality, and his face would just freeze, and he would look checked out for a while.
Well, I never found him like that ever, and I suspect that's part of the thing, part of the effect.
Yeah, it could have been jet lag, and he was maybe a little socially overstimulated. Yeah. There are some pictures that I've shared of him. After the retreat, we went back to San Francisco, and he stayed a couple of more days. And so back in my apartment in San Francisco, my living room, being in a country that didn't have guns very easily, unless you're members of the royal family or the military or something, he was fascinated with my gun collection and the there are pictures of him, clowning around with a Walther PPK and a Walther P5 and a huge 45 caliber pistol and things like that. We made sure they were empty.
He quite liked the Bond genre, so he may want to like the Walther PPK.
Oh yeah, he was doing the Bond thing. It was very entertaining. and he was really quite fun to hang around with. And some of the people at this event were quite interesting and entertaining. The Charles Kraft, the porcelain artist, was there, and I don't know if they really had a chance to talk with one another or not, but I think they would have really gotten on well if they had. And we were in Santa Cruz. It wasn't too far away from Carmel and Carmel Point, where the great American poet, I think he's the greatest American poet, Robinson Jeffers, built a house. And he built this house by hand, he and his sons, out of granite boulders, and it's called Tor House. And we made plans, first of all, to bring him back that fall for another retreat, and we were going to go to Tor House together and take a tour of that. And, of course, it wasn't to be, because he died a little more than a month after he returned home. So... at that point, I felt like I had becoming friends with him, and because he was staying at my apartment, and it was a period of about 5 or 6 days, I sort of got to see him on the various sides of his personality, the performing side, just sort of the relaxed side. He would retire fairly early and read books and fall asleep. Mm-hmm. He liked my dog. My dog was very friendly towards him, and he declared my dog Rockwell a good egg. He was just easy to get along with. He was amiable, but I do remember back in 2011 when he had his breakdown, and he wrote me this email saying that he was basically under siege. He was fearing assassination. He needed to get out. And I didn't know that it was a complete breakdown. I thought, well, who knows? Maybe Antifa doxed him or something like that. Yeah. I just said, pack your grip, fly to the United States. I've got a guest room. I can put you up. I'm kind of glad that didn't happen, because I didn't really, I wasn't really prepared to deal with somebody who was actually, psychotic.
He had a breakdown immediately before he was due to go out there on some other trip.
I think that was to go to the National Policy Institute conference that was being held in 2011.
I think it was something connected. It was the pressure of that event, I think, was the catalyst for his, because there was going to be Antifa demos there, and I believe, and well, that was what the word out was, and he various other stress and strains, I think, tipped him over the edge. And that it was like the day before, or 2 days before, or something like that, before he was due to fly out, that it happened, the breakdown happened. And
so, Adrian, can you tell some of the details about that time? Because I remember corresponding with you briefly after it started. There were stories of Jonathan stalking around with a samurai sword and a machete and being taken into custody. And it was all very dramatic and very confusing. And do you know what happened?
Sadly, this is true. He clearly had a complete mental breakdown. And his behavior in the last couple of weeks of his life was very, very disturbing and very frightening for those who were around him. He was staying at the flat of a lady well known for her revisionist sympathies, who had put him up because she'd had a very alarming telephone call from a Fetteri saying that he was in danger. He turned up this time not with a painting in a scabbard marked samurai sword, but with a samurai sword and a scabbard marked samurai sword. This was not good. She had him in her house in a state of, well, complete mental breakdown, armed with a very, very dangerous weapon and believing that his life was in danger from unknown foreign agents, assailants, etc. It was very sudden, very dramatic, and very alarming for those who had to cope.
When you spoke to him, I spoke to him on the phone when he was in this secure unit, basically, in Reading. And he would say, you know, you've been talking normally to him, and then he'd say, there's someone in the bush over there, they're, I can see them through the window, they're talking to me, they're in my head, they're saying things. And I'd say, no, there isn't, Jonathan, there's no one there, there's no voices, it's all rubbish. He goes, oh yeah, you're right. And then we go into normal conversation. They're there again. It would be like that, you know. And
Jonathan's friend and literary executor, told me, I was hoping he could join us, but I don't think he can for technical reasons. Michael Woodbridge, he told me that Jonathan was put on some kind of antipsychotic medication after his breakdown, and that he was very, very good about keeping, you know, following doctor's orders. He might be very unconventional in some ways, but he was very conventional about medicine. And one of the side effects of this medication apparently was high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And he died of a heart attack before he was 50.
It was almost certainly all linked together. He must have been on that medication when you saw him the last time.
Yes. And the pictures I have of him sitting in my living room, you know, I looked at them again and it really gave me pause, because his face is red and florid and his hands are absolutely corpse white. And those are signs that there's something amiss with his circulation.
I saw a speech he made afterwards. I saw it after he died on YouTube, and he was, it really shook me when I saw it, because it was quite a lucid speech and all that sort of thing. But his arms were rocking forward like a pendulum with every beat of his speech, and it was like very weird to watch. If you see it, you know how people, when they go mad, they rock. He was still, but his arms were going forward and forward and forward like he's giving karate chops, but both hands together to emphasize his point that he made. It was very, very disturbing to see when I saw it.
Now, I don't know. Remember if it was in the speech that he gave in Santa Cruz or it was another speech that I saw on YouTube, but I remember a kind of weird kind of swimming motion that he was doing in one of them. I think it's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, it was. I was found it quite disturbing this when I saw these things afterwards. I never saw it. I'll just cut in quite quickly. So, you know, I said that if you're a very close friend, Jonathan was my best friend for about pretty much as soon as I met him, to be honest with you. We hit it off straight away. But the last couple of years of his life, it had become increasingly difficult to be close friends with him because there were increasing areas, because I'll tell you, this water missing aspect of his life. If there became more and more areas that you couldn't discuss, and if you're very close friends with someone, they really shouldn't be discrete areas that you can't discuss, should there? Because right. You know he's too touchy about something, or there are areas you don't want to tread there because it'll set him off, or he'll be very upset, or something like that. It became increasingly difficult to, because of all these areas of you know, he paints himself as a, or his philosophy is based on Nietzscheism, isn't it? So, when he isn't anything like it personally, he says, you've got to be strong, you'll step over people and all these things. When he was getting weaker, actually more evidently weaker, and he knew that I had an attitude of, I was going to say sneering at people who are weak, but I'm not really quite like that. But he would see me as being like that. He viewed me as someone who would sneer or look down on him for being weak, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was the part of the basis of our friendship and discussions, you know. And so he felt increasingly awkward because it was becoming more and more manifest that he was lying about his bits of his life and he'd fail in doing things, or he'd bottle out of things in English. What does it mean, Adrian? Bottling out of things? You funk. I don't know. Do you know what the funk? Do you know what funk means?
Losing your nerve.
Nerve. Yeah, he would lose his nerve quite easily, actually, over many things. And that's in a way. That's why he had the breakdown. I believe that's why he had his breakdown when he was going to go to America and all this trouble was going to happen. Like he lost his nerve.
Yeah, that's very interesting. He joined the BNP. He spoke a number of times. There are recordings of 18 or so of his BNP type speeches. A couple of them are only partial, sadly. I have to say that they're pretty magnetic and mm-hmm. fascinating speeches. I understand that when you had him get up and tell him what to speak about, his actual performances were never according to plan.
Yes, that was in that, I mentioned that podcast. I listened to you, I think it as a preamble to this event now, you did a little talk on something, didn't you? Where you were talking about other things as well, but you did mention this forthcoming talk. I think you and whoever you were talking to, who's...
Yeah, my friend Gaddius. Yeah.
Yeah. Was saying, what's your favourite Jonathan speech? And I think, God, what was it called? There's one, you mentioned the one Western Man or something. What was that? You mentioned it earlier. What was that one? Western
Western Man Fights one called Back Western or something. Civilization Bites Back. Yeah.
Yeah. And, okay. I listened to that the other day. That one was a more coherent speech. To be fair, that speech he referred to the theme of what he was talking about constantly through it. So it had a thread that ran through the speech from beginning to end, that one. But the other guy said another one was his favorite one.
Credo, a Nietzschean testament, which was one of
his
earlier ones.
I listened to that. I thought, okay, this guy says that's his favorite one. That is exactly the type of speech that I was referring to in that other podcast, where he starts off saying this is about Nietzsche, and he goes off on one tangent after another that's really unconnected to each other. He would talk on a subject like, you would say something like, okay, I like Nietzsche, the greatest Western philosopher, known to man. Man's a creature, similar, it was Adam, and then it was Eve. That's in the Bible. And he'd go on for one tangent like that after another. He'd talk at greater length than that before he went off on each tangent. But he'd sort of run out of steam on one little theme, after about 5 minutes. And whatever he was talking about last on that theme, he'd gone to another theme, which would be totally unrelated, really. And the whole thing, if that thing isn't really about Nietzsche at all, because he hardly mentions Nietzsche, only knows Nietzsche's philosophy in that entire speech. He manages to speak for like an hour without notes, which he never used notes ever. It's very entertaining, very interesting, but it's totally uncoordinated and had no purpose to it, actually. He was just talking and entertaining me for an hour. And I said, that's what he would do always. And I'd say, I'd get so frustrated. I think I'm a bit of a technocrat, frankly. So I would say to him, we're going to this meeting. You're the entertaining speaker. I'm the boring speaker. Adrian thinks I'm the most boring speaker ever known to man. That's what he said. That's what he said on Earth. When Alfred Dalton died, he gave us a retrospective on him. He said, I was the most boring speaker known to man, in contrast to Jonathan, of course. And so I'd go to this meeting. So I'm going to talk about elections. I was an election specialist. And you've got to really hammer home my point so they actually pay attention to the real things, what I'm saying. But you've got to say it in a way that they actually do it, because they're not going to do it to me. When I'm just doing boring details, that it's going to be in one ear and out the other. And so he'd do it. And he wouldn't stick to the plan at all. He'd go off into flights, fancy talking about every subject under the sun. The audience would be very impressed. He's got a very broad knowledge and talk about all these things and drop names and historical allusions all the way through it. And everyone would give him a great big standing ovation at the end. They'd be thumping their fists on the table. But it wouldn't be at all. He'd totally overshadow everything I said, obviously. And he wouldn't be anything about elections. And they wouldn't go away thinking, yes, they've got to fight elections in this particular way and do this. And I'd go in the car afterwards and I'd say, and he'd be very pleased with himself, because people are probably going up to him afterwards saying, you should be the leader, Jonathan, patting on the back. You should be the leader of British nationalism. And he'd be really full of himself, get in the car, and he'd say, yes, that was going to say, bloody pathetic. That, it was useless. It was totally useless.
Oh, when he arrived in Atlanta, the next day or 2 days later, he was going to give this speech, and he mentioned offhandedly that he had no idea what he was going to talk about. I was just sort of frozen at that moment. I was just thinking, oh, this is going to be interesting. And then he got up and gave a speech that blew everybody away.
He probably said that to bait you slightly or possibly to unnerve you, because he was a bit like that as well. He liked to do that as well.
Yeah, it definitely had that effect. Adrian, I think, was the one who suggested him, and I was putting the thing together, and I thought, okay, well, I'll go on YouTube. I was trying to get Michael Walker to be invited, but that didn't work, because I really liked his speech at a Ameren conference in 2008 or something. But anyway, I was told, oh no, there's this much better English speaker, this Jonathan Bowden guy. Adrian raves about him. So I said, okay, I'll look into it. There's some of his stuff on YouTube. So I looked at a bit of a speech on YouTube of him talking about Heidegger. And, I've written a book on Heidegger, and I'm very, very into Heidegger. And I was probably the wrong thing to pick, because it just sort of set my teeth on edge listening to him talk about it for a few minutes. And I thought, oh no. But I did like his performance. I thought he had a commanding voice, and I eventually took it off, and I just thought, oh, this is going to be a debacle. And then when he said that, then I met him and I thought, well, this could be good. And then he dropped that little line before going up on stage about, I don't even know what I'm going to talk about. It was at dinner, actually. And everybody at the table was like uncomfortable, wondering, oh no, what are we in for? But yeah, he was very impressive.
He liked to make people uncomfortable. He was incredibly confident in that. That was in his element. He was in his element as a performer, really. And he liked also to make people uncomfortable. I tell a story about this where I've got a low social embarrassment threshold, and I'm probably a bit of a British stiff upper lip reticent type person, whereas he's a bit, he isn't anymore, is he? But he was a bit he's obviously flamboyant, isn't he? Mm-hmm. And perhaps not very British, actually. Really, was he? He spoke in that plummy way, which was a bit affected. That plummy voice of his wasn't really his proper accent, actually. But mm-hmm. but the he wasn't. If you think about it, he wasn't really your archetypal Englishman. Adrian is a bit of an archetypal Englishman, isn't he? He in his although he's half Croatian, of course, but. Adrian's a bit of an archetypal Englishman in how he comes across, whereas Jonathan really wasn't, was he? He's not exactly Hugh Grant, was he? In his how he presented himself.
His appearance is actually very Celtic. Sort of bright red hair. He always struck me as someone who looked more Scottish or Irish than English.
A lot of people said he should be. Whenever they saw him, they thought he should be saying, "Where's Michelle Ealy?"
Yes. he did look like a leprechaun, let's be candid, yes.
Yeah, that is very funny, and it's very true.
And he also, because I said he was very poor and he lived in very bad, very...
He lived in
humble
a
circumstances.
Camper van or something. Is that correct?
Not a caravan, yeah. Like a caravan. You'd say, like you get in America trailer parks, but a rather shabby one. But I don't even know if he had proper running in hot and cold water. I say he'd jump in your bath if you turn around.
I was basically told that he lived in a trailer. Filled with hundreds of paintings on huge pieces of paper and drawings on smaller pieces of paper, and stacks and stacks and stacks of books, some of which were stolen from from various libraries.
Well, yeah, I don't know if he's done in
or they might have been discarded.
In Hale Moy, a lot of the books in Hale Moy were ex-library. Jonathan wasn't really a tea-leaf, a thief.
He probably just got ex-library books.
In fairness. But his house, I never, his house, his caravan, I saw it from the outside, but I never saw it from the inside. I can only go on. The only person I know of who has been, who ever went inside it was Michael Woodbridge, actually. But yeah. I'm only going on what he told me. It's not fair for me to repeat what he's told me. But he would often have big clumps of unshaven bits on his cheeks where he'd missed, when he had a shave, because he probably didn't even have a mirror, I imagine. And it'd often be clumps of, bits of ginger beard stuck around his chin or lip that he'd missed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he certainly was dedicated to the life of the mind. It is kind of amazing how much he seemed to have read. Mm-hmm. He seemed to digest quite a lot. He also wrote a lot. And honestly, mm-hmm. I find most of his writing unreadable.
I've got a view on this. Before I knew him, he wrote quite a lot, and it was actually reasonably well written stuff, like for the revolutionary conservative things. And he was reasonably prolific in his writing, and he wrote sort of little books. He wrote a book on a sort of Jack Ripper type book, but thereafter, I did a magazine in about 1995 or 1996 that he was going to contribute to. I didn't get a single line out of him. We did a book with Adrian and a few other of us from the Bloomsbury Forum. We did a book called Standard Bearers, which Adrian, probably, I imagine you did two chapters, did you?
Three.
Bloody hell. I think I did two. I can't remember.
I did Joseph Chamberlain, Andrew Bonelaw, and Sir Henry Wilson.
Okay. I did Disraeli and Henty. I think I did two. Anyway, Jonathan was supposed to do several pieces for it. You couldn't get a line out of him, and he eventually did one on Bill Hopkins, which he gave to me, because I had to compile the articles and typeset them and stuff. Everyone else gave me probably in those days it was floppy disks. If you remember floppy disks, they probably all gave me on floppy. Jonathan gave me a load of incoherent scribble on bits of paper of all different sizes. I had to cobble together into the article that was about Bill Hopkins, and you just couldn't get anything out of him in a written form. I think he'd developed some sort of writer's block. I was interested. You said that he did quite a lot of writing towards the end, but in the intervening period, he did nothing, as far as I can see, in a written form.
Yeah, he started in 2010. We started publishing in 2010. I think the first thing he sent me was in August of 2010. Okay. And he wrote 30 or 40 pieces for Countercurrents between then and his breakdown in 2011, when he stopped.
And you're saying that they weren't easily readable, those things?
Well, actually, no. Those were pretty straightforwardly readable. I mean, I would have to tighten them up a little bit, because what he would do is go to the library in his town near where he lived, get on one of the library's computers, open his Hotmail account or Yahoo Mail or whatever it was, I can't remember, and without any notes or books handy, just sit down and type like he was doing a timed examination. And he would sit down and type it all out and hit send. And sometimes there were missing words and sometimes the wrong word. And shockingly, sometimes those wrong words got all the way through the editing process. And more than 10 years later, I just noticed one or two of them as I've been putting this new book together. Anyway,
I can't imagine he was a quick typist at all.
But yeah, it was. They were interesting. He wrote things on popular culture, dystopian literature, Robert E. Howard. A lot of the things he would write were quite short, some 1,000 words, some 2,000 or 3,000. I don't think the longest was over 3,000 words. But it was all interesting, and I enjoyed it. And he seemed to enjoy the feedback from writing at Countercurrents. Mm. And one of the reasons I got him a laptop and a microphone is that the world of podcasting was just on the horizon. Right. And yeah. I thought he would be absolutely wonderful at that. And I wanted him to have a proper computer at home so he could do some writing. But you know, again, it just didn't work out. He ran out of time, sadly. But he was, he published a bunch of books on an imprint called the Spinning Top Club.
Yeah.
Those are still in print. You can order them from lulu.com. And I found most of those sort of unreadable, just sort of bizarre and unreadable, with his very colorful paintings on the covers. Strange stuff. The last two of them that he wrote, one is called Locusts Devour a Corpse and the other Spiders Are Not Insects. Are collections of short stories that are actually quite readable and interesting. They're entertaining. I actually found them entertaining and not like, oh, where is he going with this? But the earlier ones were just kind of unreadable. And then he apparently published a bunch of things in the 90s that Alex Kurdigich started republishing, then just sort of dropped it. And those had this sort of stream of consciousness quality to them that, I just didn't get into it as written literature.
There's a degree to which he had a slight element of being an artistic poser,
and so exactly. I liked his visual art, although I'm not really a great lover of modern art, to be perfectly honest. But it certainly had energy to it. There's no question about that. It was vital. Some of it was very well composed in odd ways. But I read this book he wrote called Sod, and I thought, it's kind of phony. It's kind of this fugue of tropes from this sort of continental, pompous, academic.
There's an element to which he was trying too hard, wasn't he, on some of those things? And that spinning top thing he did. It was actually a club they had meetings, put it that way. They had these irregular meetings in North London somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he knew, because it was all this arty-farty pseudo-nationalistic, sort of nationalistic-y, fringy, right-wing type stuff, but all slightly impractical. And so he would go to these meetings. I was very close to him. And he said, oh, I'm in North London, I've got to go to this meeting. Okay, these people. And he would never invite me because he knew that I'd go there and I'd look at these people and I'd think, what a bunch of tossers, you know, what a bunch of wasters. And he'd say, oh, you won't like it, you won't like it, you won't like these people. And I went to one, right? He eventually invited me one, and he just knew I was looking at them all with sort of thinly veiled contempt for being a bunch of waffling nobody, blowhards. And he was a bit embarrassed about it, but he liked that. So that was they all sort of out the palm of his hand, you know, and saw him as a sort of guru or something. And that's why he liked it, I think.
Do you know any of these people? I would absolutely love to track some of them down and get their impressions of him, because that would be very interesting.
I can't really remember. I only went to one. There was one guy who was his real enemy, who ironically I heard lived in a place where his house was probably waist high in newspapers and books, and you had to walk around little narrow corridors to get from one room to the other because the whole it was just full of which is exactly how Jonathan lived. But I think it was Jonathan who told me that. But this guy, yeah. They're almost going to, every time they went to these meetings together, they'd almost have a punch up. Him and this other guy, they sort of saw each other as rivals for it.
That's interesting.
I can't remember the guy's name. There's a guy called Adrian. Was it Troy Southgate? He probably knew Jonathan from that circle, didn't he? Am I right?
Yeah, yes. Jonathan used to speak at Troy's meetings very frequently.
I don't really know him, but I think that he was more in part of that world, I think.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, Jonathan spoke at 33 meetings of Troy Southgate's New Right London. Yeah. And 23 of those were recorded. And it pains me to no end that 10 of them were just never recorded for whatever reason, because they were on fascinating topics like Céline or Leni Riefenstahl or F.W. Murnau. It would have been fascinating to have heard his talks on that. That's interesting. I want to find out who published these Spinning Top Club books, because obviously somebody with some technical know-how put the books together, put the covers together. Mm-hmm. I'd also like to have tracked down who created the jonathanbowden.co.uk website that he had for a while. I think that went down in 2011 when he had his breakdown. There was some interesting stuff on there, lots of pictures of his paintings that were professionally photographed. So there were some people in that circle who seemed to have some technical means and were willing to help him get published, which I really appreciate. I think history really will appreciate it. That website of his, the domain name is still registered to somebody. I don't know who. The site's been offline for 11 years, and the domain name still is registered. It's been renewed all this time, which is interesting.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know. Michael Woodbridge might know.
Yeah, I've asked Michael about that, and he's drawing a blank on that too. Well, can you both share your thoughts about his legacy? Has he influenced your thought in any way?
I think Jonathan's insights into important books were important for many people, including myself. I will never forget his analysis. It was at one of Troy's, I think, meetings of George Orwell's 1984, which was a very interesting insight into such a well-known book where he still was able to make some very, very novel observation that I hadn't thought about before. I've always liked that book. Although one of the things I find disturbing, Eddie says some people think he has an unsympathetic character and is harsh on the weak. One of the things I find worrying is that when I read that book at 17, I sympathized with Winston Smith, and rereading it 40 years later, I thought Smith was a complete wuss and I just loved O'Brien, which is quite worrying. But Jonathan was very interesting about it. And there are many other things. I want, there's one in particular of his speeches to Troy's group I want to find, because I never got around to reading the damn book, which is a big mistake on my part. Of course, I now can't ask Jonathan to remind me of the author and title. But yes, Jonathan's also in a way lucky in the sense that anyone with a gift for speaking who has lived in the last 100 years is lucky. We're never going to hear what Demosthenes or Cicero, or to take more sinister figures from relatively more recent past, the Danton or Robespierre were like when they made their speeches. Their speeches may be written down and we've got records of the effect they had on the audience and so on. You know, you never see a speech by any of these people, or you never see a speech by Abraham Lincoln. I don't think I'd want to, but supposing you did want to, you never can, because he died before sound recording was invented. With Jonathan, he has that advantage over some speakers from the past, that what was historically a very transitory form has now become permanent through recording. He will influence people, I think, in the future. And the strange thing about Jonathan is that he seems to have acquired a remarkable posthumous fan club, often of younger people who'd never met him and never heard him speak in the flesh, which really surprises me, frankly. Because as you say, and I share, Greg, your view of his books, they are very, very difficult to read and understand, which is possibly because they don't actually have a meaning. And his speeches, however, were insightful, and they will live on.
Yeah, I think the fact that he often didn't speak on what Eddie wanted him to speak on is an interesting, sort of backstage, how the sausage is made kind of story. At least the speeches that I've heard, and again, there are about 18 of these stump speeches that have been recorded, partially or fully. A lot of them are really quite compelling. They're interesting and rousing. A lot of his lectures on various writers, I think, are very good.
Yes.
Sometimes I know, where his source material. I know who he's. Which book he read about them and stuff like that. I mean, he was doing some research, definitely. I think that he was very, very successful in communicating the importance of ideas and literature and intellectuality to a lot of people, and including a whole generation of people who in the last 10 years or so started listening to him when they were teenagers. He's put a positive spin, a positive direction on the lives of a lot of people who have become fans of his. He's encouraged them to become more cultured and deepen themselves and improve themselves. So I think that's very, very good. For me personally, he did a couple of things. He convinced me, and I know other people have said this, Norberto Bobbio has said this, Paul Gottfried has said this, but for me, it was Jonathan who really drove this point home, which is that the essential distinction between the left and the right has to do with equality. And I think that that's correct, and I think that it's clarifying, and I've taken that. I also very much liked his sort of crisp formulations about cultural struggle, about metapolitics, about the importance of extremists. Those things made an impression on me. And he influenced my having the ambition of creating a sort of system of political ideas, which I'm still sort of tinkering on. I think that ambition was something that he gave me. When I first got started with Countercurrents, I just sort of thought of myself as an editor and an entrepreneur, basically an editor and an entrepreneur. And I was looking for other people's ideas and translating people like Dominic Venner and Alain de Benoit and people like that. And spending time with Jonathan, listening to him, especially the time we spent together in 2012, it really made me feel that I needed to be a little bit more ambitious in what I wanted to do in the world of ideas and the world of politics. So those were things that influenced me. He also introduced me to Bill Hopkins, I'd never heard of, and that was a great find, an absolutely fascinating find. Trying to think of some other people he introduced me to that I really came to appreciate. I thought his speech on Orwell was full of interesting surprises. That's definitely true. Matt Tate is joining us. Matt, are you there? Can you hear us okay?
Hi, Greg. Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Well, we're here with Adrian Davis and Eddie Butler, and I'd like to hear from you now. You knew Jonathan for a good while. Can you tell us when you first met him, what your first impression was, and we'll just go from there, and we'll just have sort of a roundtable conversation. But I would like to get you on the record because you're one of the younger people, certainly the youngest in this conversation, and you were a young friend of his. It'd be great to hear your perspective.
Sure. Well, hello, Adrian. Hello, Eddie. I first met
evening,
Jonathan.
Matt.
Good evening. I first met Jonathan, I guess, when I was about 19 years old. At the time, I was an enthusiastic member of the BNP. And meeting Jonathan kind of happened in an unplanned kind of a way. I was really just meeting a friend of mine called Mike Woodbridge for a drink in a pub. And he told me that a friend of his who was a bit of an intellectual and an artist was going to come and join us. And I understand that Jonathan was out trying to sell a small sculpture of some kind to an art collector. And when he showed up at the pub, it seemed that he'd been unsuccessful in that task because he still had the sculpture with him. My first impression of him really was that he was quite a strange character. I mean, for me at 19, I was quite sort of inexperienced and naive about the world still. And Jonathan being such a unique character, he was quite fascinating. And he seemed quite sort of intense. I would say it would be my first reaction having a conversation with him. He was quite intense. I don't really remember the details much more of what conversation we had at the time, but that was my first time meeting him because he lived in the same locality as me in England at the time. I would see him fairly often after that, even with him and Mike turning up unexpected at my front door one Sunday morning with a set of dominoes, just wanting to come in and play dominoes with me for some reason. So my first sort of interactions with Jonathan weren't really with him as an intellectual or as a political figure. It was really just a friend of a friend. But after that, I understood that these meetings in London, which were known as the New Right, were going to be created with the primary objective of giving Jonathan a place to speak. And I had absolutely no idea what to expect. But from the very first time that I heard him speak, I knew that this was something really special. And it was so special that I thought, how can this not be recorded? I mean, it was still somewhat early days of the internet, so you didn't have YouTube really back then. I'm talking about sort of 2005. But I thought at some point we need to, you know, this could be useful for posterity. It should be recorded. So I didn't have a job or anything, but I managed to scrape together about £80 to buy a dictaphone. And I started to record the speeches that he made. And a lot of the audio-only recordings that are available online were recorded by me. I think later someone else decided to do the video recordings, and so the video recordings online aren't anything to do with me.
Well, let me just say thank you, because you preserved a lot of very, very important speeches that otherwise would have just been lost if nobody else had thought to record them. There are a lot of people out there who are huge fans of Jonathan, myself included, who are in your debt because of that.
Well, I'm not sure how many of them weren't caught on video and were only caught on audio, but I think there are at least a few.
Yeah, I made a count. I've been doing basically creating the various pages or the information for the various pages that are going to be on this Jonathan Bowden archive site. And there's a listing of all of his speeches that he gave at the London New Right. And there were 33 of them, and 23 of them have no recordings, known recordings. Some of them were audio. Some of them were videoed. I don't remember exactly how many were video as opposed to audio only. There are about 8 other lectures that are fairly substantive that were given at other meetings. One at this group called Iona, some at the London Forum, one in Atlanta that sadly wasn't recorded, and the speech he gave for Countercurrents in 2012 near the end of his life. So the 7 out of 8 of those were recorded in some way. And then there are 18 stump speeches that have come down to us. One's a very short one. It was at this BNP Ideas conference. And others were longer, you know, full-length speeches. And 2 of those are only available in partial versions because, well, in one case, somebody created a channel and was putting Jonathan's stuff online, and he was putting it up. This is early YouTube, and putting things up in 10-minute segments. And he put the first 10-minute segment up, and then never brought any of the others out. It was a speech in Manchester, and there's another speech in Liverpool, I believe, where the only version is somebody's sort of best of compilation from this speech in Liverpool. And I'd love to know where the full things are of these, but so. You know, the total number of recordings of his sort of substantive intellectual speeches is 30. There are 30 of those, and 16 stump speeches in full. And then there are a few things that he did sort of just with a tape recorder where he was talking about Elgar or Shakespeare or British sculpture, the Turner Prize, things like that. At least one of those has been listed by various people as a thing on British painting, but I've never been able to find any versions of it. So, you know, there are about 50 recordings of Jonathan speaking. They're very, very interesting. So I wish there was more, but we got, I don't know how many speeches he gave for the BNP. He could have done dozens and dozens that were never recorded, or just the recordings haven't been put online. But a good percentage of the London Forum and New Right speeches are recorded. And you're the one who got that started. So we have to thank you for that.
Well, I'm glad to have played a little part in keeping what Jonathan did alive and available for people to hear even 10 years and beyond after his death. I mean, I'd be very interested to see the compiled list that you've got, and to cross-reference that with anything, any knowledge that I might have, or anyone that I might think to reach out to see if they might have a recording.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago, you found some speeches that you had recorded that were previously unknown. I was extremely excited by that. And so those were dubbed and transcribed and put up at Countercurrents. So yeah, I'm always hoping that more Jonathan recordings will come to light. I was hoping that one guy had surreptitiously recorded his speech in Atlanta because he was known for recording lectures. But no, he was a good boy, and he didn't record anything because that was against the rules. And I just wanted to shake him and say, you know, I wish you weren't such a good boy about this, and had managed to preserve this for posterity.
But, yeah, I've always been quite curious about that famous speech, because word got back to me from any number of people over in the US that I knew saying, yeah, who is this guy? He just came out of nowhere. We've never heard of him. And he just delivered the best speech that we've ever heard. And he had the whole room absolutely gripped. And I've always been curious to find out, was that speech especially good? Or was it just their first experience of Jonathan? And actually, it would just be sort of in keeping with everything else that we know of his speeches.
Well, Adrian,
I was there, Matt, and even by his standards, it was exceptional. It was a real tour de force. I was very impressed with that speech indeed, and I think just about everyone in the room was, with one exception actually, as one of the guests, who's someone whom I have a high regard, was not impressed and said so to me privately afterwards. But that was a one-off view. I thought it was a remarkable speech. Sam Dixon thought it was a remarkable speech. Jared Taylor was very impressed with it. It was an extraordinary performance.
I remember some little phrases from it. You know, he was talking about this cloud that pops up to suppress European self-confidence and so forth. It was always popping up, referring to the Second World War. And another thing, he had some very amusing line about Sarah Palin, who was sort of a figure at the time. And I the only thing I remember from it, because it cracked me up, he says, "And the moose is in the oven." It's just his portrait of Sarah Palin, the frontier woman from Alaska who became a political figure. But yeah, there was a lot of substance to it. It was a very powerful speech. It was uplifting. And it was about the moral funk, basically, that has rotted, the Western spirit and gotten us to this situation where we've gone from ruling the world in basically one century to losing control of our own homelands. And he very much stressed the importance of the moral factor in understanding that. And I was impressed by that. And I agree with that. And sometimes Jonathan would say things that I agreed with and I already knew. But the most influential thing was just how beautifully he would crystallize it. It's like, yeah, I know that, but I've never heard it said so well. And it's never, struck as deep as when he said it. So that was one of the things that was impressive to me about his gift of oratory and just conversation. Matt, what are your favorite talks by him? And do you have some amusing Jonathan anecdotes you want to share?
Well, there's probably quite a lot of amusing anecdotes. In terms of my favorite speeches, it's been a while since I revisited a lot of these things, but I do remember the talks on, they always often had long names, but Marxism and the Frankfurt School. Is it Ian Stuart Holm or something like that? This leftist figure.
Stuart Holm, yeah.
Stuart Holm. I remember him talking about, I don't know, these leftist books that would sort of have book covers made of sandpaper or whatever, so that they irritated the books on the shelf next to them, The thing that made that so amusing is that Jonathan found that so amusing. And his laughter was just this gigantic sound, it's a wall of sound would hit you when he suddenly laughed. I remember, when I was a kid, I would do karate, and you go up and down in a line and you do five punches or whatever, and then you have to shout "Kiai" at the end. And his laugh was kind of like this attack. His laugh was like this sort of weapon that anyone in the room who was nodding off or something after listening to four other speeches that day would suddenly be awake again. But I think some of the stuff that really amused me about Jonathan were his impressions. He did very good impressions of people like, who is the Ulster leader?
Paisley?
Yes, Ian Paisley. He had a very good impression of Ian Paisley, which he liked to pull out of the bag from time to time.
It was interesting. He had a great voice, and he could do impressions, but he couldn't do American accents. He would try and do American accents, and it just didn't work. So he needed to spend more time with American accents. But he could do. He was so entertaining when he would just be telling stories, and he would, you know, be doing dialogues and going back and forth with different voices. That was very funny. He was quite talented at that, but not the American accent. He couldn't do a Southern accent very well.
Well, if only he was here with us for more time, then he would have had any number of American friends to get coaching from, I think, now.
Yeah, exactly.
Another impression that I remember him using quite continually was an impression of his own father, who he characterized as being a sort of typical boomer, middle of the road, doesn't want to rock the boat, sort of, you know, orthodox opinion, but up to, you know, conservative leaning orthodox opinion. And I'd be surprised if that doesn't crop up in one of his recorded speeches, because I know that he used to do that impression very often. One of the personal things I always remember with Jonathan is after a New Right meeting or a London Forum meeting, we would often walk through the streets of central London, going to a bar or to one of the clubs that we would go to afterwards. And he'd be talking away, and he'd almost be like a blind man. His eyes have shut down so that all focus could go onto his thinking. And he would almost walk into lampposts and, you know, into main roads. You know, you had to sort of guide him with your shoulder as you would a blind man around obstacles.
Well, that's very entertaining. So do you remember some of his speeches, though, that impressed you? Everyone, you know, I'm always asking, what's your favorite Jonathan speech? So.
Well, I heard him give this the same basic speech twice, and it was about Punch and Judy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a long time since I heard it, but both times that I heard him give a speech that was based on Punch and Judy, I found that incredibly entertaining. You know, I think it was educational as well as entertaining, which is really what Johnson did best. And actually, just to come back to the point that you made earlier about how well he crystallized things, I think it's quite remarkable for Jonathan, as a man who isn't exactly a man of the people exactly, to be able to say about him that he wasn't just an intellectual, he wasn't just a mind, but he was actually a very good popularizer. And he could take these big subjects, these big insights into society, and go to the most working class branch of a BNP meeting, and there'd be 200 blokes there with pints. And he would be just as well received there as he would anywhere else. And I think that one of the legacies he has is not just the crystal clear thinking he had about these things, but the way that he managed to popularize that to basically everyone.
Yeah, I can agree with that. He liked deep theory, but he was also very into popular culture, popular literature, comic books, graphic novels, and Punch and Judy. Yeah, Punch and Judy was one of the things that we transcribed that speech for the first collection I brought out from Countercurrents, which was called Pulp Fascism. And we had actually talked about this project before he died, and you know, he was going to write a bunch of other things. He was going to write something on James Bond. I really wish he had written something on James Bond. That would have been very interesting. But he just didn't have the time. And I thought the project would never come to fruition. And then one day I started just looking at what he had published and started making a list and realized, no, we could actually get a respectable book of just Jonathan talking about sort of rightist themes in popular culture. And so that was the first one we put together. And then we put together a collection called Western Civilization Bites Back, which has the revisionism talk and a few other things in there that all sort of center around the moral funk issue and the moral revolution we need to basically recover our sense of identity and our sense of destiny. And I love those speeches. That's a very good collection. And then I put out Extremists, which is just about basically portraits of extreme figures like Savitri Devi and Mishima and D'Annunzio and Morat, people like that. And now I'm bringing out for his birthday a collection called Reactionary Modernism, which is his speeches on Ezra Pound and Yeats, Wyndham Lewis, T.S. Eliot, the Stuart Holmes speech that you like so much, which is very entertaining. And then some essays that he wrote, mostly for Countercurrents, on various Wyndham Lewis books, and wrote a piece on Arno Breker, stuff like that. One of the things that was so funny, he loved the stories about this Italian artist named Manzoni, who would basically take, as he put it, turds. He'd take his own turds and gild them and put them in elaborate boxes and sell them as art. And there's this one speech where he's really on a tear, and he's just talking about how the left, it's never enough. It's never enough, you know. And at one point, you know, she barks out, turds in a box. It's not enough. You know, everything has to be radicalized still more. And that absolutely had me floored, because I was wondering what the people in that room were thinking at the time, because he was just barking this out. It was very, very funny. How has he influenced your thinking?
Well, I'm largely out of political stuff now, but to try and think back to how he influenced me, I suppose he met me as someone who had a very basic understanding of what I was involved in and enriched it in every way. And I think the thing that probably stands out for me is his talks about the left, about the enemy, if you like, and the way they operate, how they've had success through cultural means rather than through political means. So I guess I've always had a practical outlook on things. I wanted to achieve something. I wanted to try and get something done in an effective way. And I think his insights into that really did make me a lot more aware of how these things have been done. And also, you know, in a way, how we can frame what we're trying to do in resistance to that in a more effective way.
So, Eddie, can you tell us some of the things that he influenced you on, and some of the things that you think are of enduring value for nationalism that you learned from Jonathan?
Jonathan, as Adrian said earlier, he's a bit like Vincent van Gogh in that in his he's sort of strangely developed this greater popularity after death now, which is obviously much more of a legacy than virtually anyone involved in this business is ever going to have. There's probably more of his speeches, strangely, were recorded than anyone. You're sort of bewailing the fact that a lot of them weren't, which is inevitable, because he did do a lot of speeches or talks and things, and because that was his forte. And but a surprisingly quite large proportion are there available to be seen and seen for future generations. So that's going to be his main legacy, obviously. One thing that he did do, which hasn't been mentioned, which is very good at it, so Adrian touched upon this, is that in the BNP we had this thing called the Red, White and Blue, which was a weekend festival. And where people would camp or stay out and there'd be events put on. And I ran the political event side of it. And we did this thing called a mock press conference that Jonathan did, not press interview. So he would take on the role of a enemy mainstream journalist interviewing one of our people. And people, it would be like a gladiatorial contest. So our people would put their hands up, I'll challenge him, and he'd ask probing questions, and there'd be this banter, and it'd sort of defeat everybody pretty much and tear them to shreds. But people, it was one of the most popular events at the Red One. You must have seen this, Matt.
Yeah, I remember I was there.
Did you put yourself up against him?
I honestly can't remember. It's too long ago.
But no one stood a chance, sort of thing. And you'd trip them up, you know, and but it would be one of the most popular parts of the red, white, and blue, the tent, the big top that it was held in, or the great big marquee, would be absolutely crammed with people because, and you know, after a while, you know, initially people want to do it, put their hands up, and this person, I'd have to go over the microphone, drag this person out, and Jonathan would tell him, after about the first 10, you know, less people were volunteering because he literally, you know, he literally taught the shows because he was very quick. That was why he was a good speaker without notes, because he could think very quickly on the go. His mind was very good at that. If you could see those before, none of those were recorded, I don't think, but they were very good performances. They were the most impressive performances. They were sort of entertaining. It was very entertaining in that environment as well. And that he was really on his mettle when he did that. I used to enjoy that. Just let me just say one thing. You were asking Adrian this question about his interest in the opposite sex. And because I suspected that, and that there were rumours put abroad by his enemies that he's perhaps gay or something, but he wasn't at all. And he did have, you know, there were several women that I know of that he developed huge passions for. So, you know, definitely wasn't gay. He definitely had, he was a relatively hot-blooded in that respect, actually.
Yeah, looking at his art, it was impossible to think that he wasn't heterosexual, just given the topics that he was drawn to and the different ways that he would treat the female and male bodies. Most of the male bodies were just sort of dumpy, sad-looking figures, but the women were sort of centerfold types, you know.
Yeah.
So I always thought that was revealing. Adrian, can you, we're sort of wrapping up. Can you talk a bit about, well, how he influenced your thinking and the influence you think he can have and should have on nationalism in the future? Well, the lessons we can learn from him.
I think that in England in particular, since 1945, the culture of the non-liberally liberal, if you like, right, non-libertarian right, has almost been a contradiction in terms. It was either a nostalgia for a rapidly disappearing past or simply anti-intellectual. And Jonathan came to one of the most anti-intellectual right-wing movements in the world that was, frankly, an embarrassment in many respects, and actually introduced some of its more promising members to the battle of ideas. In France, this would be commonplace. And frankly, in the US, you are better at this than we are. In England, that was a remarkable achievement. He was one of the few people to have done this. Michael Walker did some good work in that regard back in the 80s, but that was a very long time ago. And yes, that is what Jonathan has done. He's actually introduced the English right to intellectualism, which is quite an achievement, quite an achievement.
Yes, so I want to end by thanking some people who have sent donations in the course of the stream. Richard sent 100 euros to Entropy, which is quite generous. And he says, thank you, Greg, for archiving much of Jonathan Bowden's work. Keep up the good work. Well, thank you. I'm going to put that 100 euros towards the archive. It's a website. I'm paying a coder. So that'll go in the hopper. And if anybody else out there would like to donate, you can go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, and you can use a credit card to help out. We can also take donations through Cash App. Both of the addresses are at the bottom of the screen. Also, over at DLive, we have been streaming. And at DLive, people send in tokens, not matchsticks or toothpicks, but diamonds, lemons, ninjaginis, and things like that. So Slog has donated 5 lemons, Bartleby 1 ice cream, Cyan, thank you, 1 diamond, Rory, 1 lemon, 1,001 cuts, 1 diamond, 1,001 cuts, and ice cream, and 4 lemons. Marcus, 6 ice cream, Slog, 14 lemons, Anglian, 1 lemon, Vegbereiter, 1 diamond, Lovecraft, 1 diamond, Serena, 6 ice creams, and 1 lemon donator has donated 1 lemon. Thank you very much. I like your sense of style. Folks, if you want to help out with Countercurrents, just toss those tokens this way. We will cash them out, and I appreciate it tremendously. Adrian has some copies of this book called, what is it, Standard Bearers, which has his articles in it. It has articles, an article by Jonathan. Eddie Butler is in there. He wrote the Henty piece. I read the Henty piece, but I didn't associate it with you. It's a very good collection. And one thing I like about this book is that it's an attempt to do something that every nation needs to do, which is to look into its own tradition and find sensible figures that the nationalist populist right can go back to and resuscitate, because that's how you build a much more authentic movement that's rooted in your own history. And you don't have to go back too far in every European society before you find some very sensible people, the United States included. So I like that approach. And it's about the British contributors, basically, or forefathers of the New Right. I shared a link to his Telegram, or not shared a link to his Twitter on our Telegram channel. It's been shared in the Bowden Archive group on Telegram too. So folks, if you want to get a copy of that, those are rapidly running out, and then it will be gone forever. So follow those links and you can own those. Countercurrents is bringing out in 2 weeks' time another collection of Jonathan's work. So that's welcome. And I just want to end by asking each of the people in the stream how people can follow your work if you have a public platform. First of all, Eddie, are you producing, as they like to say, content? Or what are you doing? Where do people follow you if they want to follow you?
Okay. I have got a YouTube channel, but I don't really do much on it nowadays. I've always been more of a political activist and a doer rather than somebody who does content channels and that sort of stuff. I run election campaigns and I fight elections and try and win elections. That's what I'm really sort of known for, I suppose, actually, rather than
So, Adrian, you have a Twitter. Is that?
Well, I contribute. I don't run the Bloomsbury Forum Twitter in the sense it's not mine. I contribute to it quite frequently, but it's not my exclusive Twitter feed by any means. The number of people who contribute to that, I can't say that I am creating a vast amount of new content these days. I'm sorry to say I've reached the age of 59, and even more sorry to say I've reached the age of 59 without making my fortune, something I've been trying unsuccessfully to do for about the past 30-odd years. And I'm very much, I suppose, preoccupied with work these days. I'm working harder than I ever have done in my life, which is most disagreeable, I can tell you. Yes, I've done quite a lot of writing in the past, quite a lot of speaking, some of which is on the internet itself, I gather. I never watch, I'm proud to say, I've never watched one of the, I gather, quite large number of speeches and so on that I've made. That may be a reflection on modesty. I think it's just a reflection on preoccupation. I told there is a lot of stuff up on the internet. I just never have time to look at it myself.
Well, you are one of these people who's creating speeches and therefore doesn't have the time to watch them. That's the way I am. I know people who, they must spend hours every day looking at videos. I just create them. I don't have time to watch them. but you are a very effective speaker. And if there are videos of Adrian out there speaking, seek them out, because I think they're well presented and very, very informative. So yeah, that's definitely something I recommend. Have you been writing at all for, what's that magazine? You wrote something on Raspi after he died for them. I'm ashamed I'm not remembering the name properly.
Well, I think you're right now. That ceased publication some time ago. Not aware of anything else that's publishing in hard copy comparable to right now at the moment.
Okay.
But yes, I mean, I still do some writing. I do the occasional book review for Mark Cottrell's Heritage and Destiny magazine, which is an interesting magazine. I hasten to say I don't endorse everything in it. There's material there that's much too much, shall we say, orientated to foreign regimes. But I've written some book reviews for that over the years. If I were a gentleman of leisure, I would be doing a lot more than I am. I do what I can around a very full professional life and business interests, which keep me working much harder than I anticipated doing at this stage in my life. But there you are.
Well, I very much appreciate your time. I know that you charge a good deal by the hour. And
not you, Greg, not you. I didn't charge you anything.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your time in this and your contributions because this is how we build the materials for a biography. Someday somebody's going to write a biography of Jonathan, and they're going to be listening to live streams like this and piecing things together. So I tremendously appreciate it. And I'm going to follow up definitely on the Revolutionary Conservative because I definitely like to see that. Matt, do you have a platform, or are you just sort of, you said you sort of stepped away from political stuff. Are you active in social media? Is there a place where people can follow you?
Well, I'm not a content creator of any kind. I'm not engaged in anything political. If you had a mind to, you could find me on Facebook or on Twitter. But it's just for my own personal stuff, really. I could give a shout out, since Jonathan was a very keen pagan. Shout out to a good YouTube channel called Survive the Jive, which covers mostly European paganism and ancient history, I suppose. As my closing thought, I suppose I just wanted to say that it's great to be invited on here. I was quite surprised to find out that it was 10 years since he died.
I still can't believe it myself.
Yeah. I mean, I really feel the absence of Jonathan in the world, and it's only thanks to, I guess, all of us, but particularly like to thank Greg for all of the transcriptions and all of the work you've done to preserve Jonathan's work, and thank you to everyone else out in the world who's doing the same. He may be dead, but so long as we keep doing that, he won't be gone.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank all of you so much, Adrian, Eddie, Matt. This has been enlightening and enjoyable, and we will definitely be following up. I'll definitely be following up on some of the leads that you've given, because I want to talk to more people who knew him. And this will be perhaps the first in a number of live streams and later podcasts that will be archived at this Bowden Archive, just as the basis of sort of an oral history of Jonathan, because that's how he lives on. Again, he's gone, but his posthumous survival is really up to us now. And I'm glad that you've been able to inaugurate something new on this anniversary. So thank you very much, folks. We will be back on Saturday at our normal time for Countercurrents Radio, and until then. You can catch this, tomorrow or Thursday, we will have the replay of this available at the Countercurrents. So thank you very much, and we will be back on Saturday.